And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning in Southeast Kansas. Hope everybody is having a fantastic day. And it's now time for Green Side Up. And joining me in studio this morning are James Coover and Jesse Gilmore. And gentlemen, good morning. How are you doing today?
Good morning. Thanks for asking.
Good to see you guys in studio today. And Jesse will lead it off here in just a moment. But first, James, you guys have a program coming up, correct?
Yes, and so we have a pretty big program coming up, actually. Next week, we're going to have the Spring Crop Field Day, and that will be at the Southeast Center in Parsons. And so basically this day, it's more like a showcase, a tour of the Southeast Center and all the research they have going on down there. And so we're going to walk the fields and look at all the things that they have growing. The big highlight is actually the wheat tour. They have 41 variety wheat plot out there. And so we're going to walk through the variety plots and talk about the strengths of each individual wheat variety. We'll have the pathologist and the other wheat specialist there to talk about those. And actually, we'll have soft wheat there too, which is kind of odd for Kansas because we're the only area that grows soft wheat. And so that's a big day. It's going to be on May 19th, and it'll be from about 8:30 to noonish. It'll be at the Southeast Center in Parsons, and we'll talk about a bunch of other things, pathology and soil fertility, cover crops. And so that big day, if anyone's interested, just give any of the local offices a call, or you can call the Altamont office or the Southeast Center, in fact. Also, the week after that will be tractor safety. And that will be on the 27th and 28th. And really, this is kind of for any farm kid, any teenager can go to this. But the 14 and 15-year-olds will actually get their certification to work on an off-farm, a non-family farm farm. And so, you know, they'll get their certification to do that. But really, it's a good idea for any farm teenager. Because, you know, teenagers think they're invincible. And so you kind of need to scare them a little bit with some tractor safety class. And let's teach them, you know, the things that they should not be doing that we all did as kids. And so it's good for pretty much any farm teenager.
Oh, yeah. I remember thinking, oh, yeah, nothing could hurt me. Yeah, and then I end up getting hurt. So,
it's all happened.
So. All right. Well, it's just a part of learning sometimes. All right. Well, thanks a lot, James. As those programs are coming up, we'll come back to those here in just a few minutes. But we're going to go ahead and start off with Jesse. And Jesse, good morning. And today you're going to be talking about wildflowers, correct?
Yeah. Going a little more natural today than the heavily curated landscape garden type. Wildflowers are a topic that's really increasing in popularity, so I wanted to cover some of the basics about wildflowers for anyone who might be interested in a more low-maintenance type planting.
So for wildflowers, what are they, and how can you tell a wildflower at just a glance?
Wildflowers, that's a tricky term to describe. You ask 10 people and you might get 8 different answers for what a wildflower is. There's a lot of, not misconceptions, but a lot of people think that wildflowers are specifically natives. And while that is typically true, sometimes they are not necessarily native and they're introduced, but they're to the point where they are widespread in the wild. For example, there's a plant called Dame's Rocket that's everywhere right now. You will, if you're driving on pretty much any Kansas highway, especially around like windbreaks and field edges, you'll see this really purple flower. That's called Dame's Rocket, also known as Hesperus matronalis. It was introduced from, I think it was Europe, and it is everywhere now. It is pretty much considered invasive at this point. And that kind of is a good example of a wildflower that self-seeds to the point where it will come back year after year and has dense stands of the plant in the wild with no real help from an individual. When people talk about wildflowers, typically what they're going to be thinking of are self-seeding annuals or hardy perennials like black-eyed Susan. that occur in the wild with no particular selection or cultivation from an individual. And that kind of explains a lot of why they're really popular right now, is because once they're established, they are very low maintenance and usually will come back year after year. It is always important to check if you're buying, for example, a wildflower seed packet, to check the species that are included to make sure that they are native, or at least a good majority of them are native. Just because it's introduced doesn't mean that it's going to be harmful to surrounding ecology, but you do always want to lean for native plants if possible, because they will be more adapted to our climate than introduced species will, and will typically have lower maintenance needs. You can find wildflower seed packets pretty much everywhere. Walmart, other retail stores, garden centers will have them. I know that in our independence office, the NRCS group that shares our building gives away wildflower seed packets as kind of a conservation effort. And those, I'm almost 100% sure, will not have any introduced species because of the conservation goals. Planting wildflowers can be, well, it depends on the person why you would want to plant wildflowers, but I would say that generally people plant them for the low maintenance. You know, planting is the hardest part and getting them established. And once they establish, they pretty much go off on their own.
So if you were wanting to plant a wildflower garden, how would you start doing that?
So wildflowers are not particularly picky about the specific site conditions. They can grow in a soil with a pH anywhere from 5.5 to about 8.0, which I think, with one notable exception, covers pretty much every soil in our area. They do need full sun. There are very few wildflowers that will grow in heavy shade. I think wild violet is probably the only exception I can think of. So if you have a shadier position, wildflower plantings might not be a great, great idea, since they will lag behind their growth in denser shade and allow weeds to overtake them more easily. The first step is to kill off any existing vegetation that might be in the spot you want your wildflower garden. Weed competition is going to be the number one reason for failure in a wildflower garden, for lack of establishment or lack of growth, essentially. You want to rake the soil surface before planting the seeds. What you're aiming for there is good seed to soil contact, which is needed for a dense establishment. Density is the one thing you want to aim for. And usually wildflower seeds will come in packets that basically crowd out any weed competition once they establish. Right at the start is when you need to do most of your weed control. Typically, once they do establish, they will produce a lot of seeds. Yarrow is one very common plant that's considered a wildflower, or if you're in field crop context, it's commonly a weed. It produces about 43,000 plants per acre. Just from one plant. So that's kind of the seed production levels that we're talking about. So the density will take care of itself as you get that established, and it comes back year after year. Once established, clearly, they should reseed with little work from you, but you do need to make sure that you keep the plot that you're growing in constantly watered in order to have as much germination from those seed packets as possible. If you do want to find wildflowers and gather seeds from those wildflowers, I would say that's probably recommended over buying seed packets, just because there's a concept called provenance, which is where the seed is gathered from and then distributed from. Being able to go out and gather seed from wildflowers as they are growing in our area makes it more likely that they will have the genetics needed to survive our particular conditions. Whereas if you're importing seeds from elsewhere, it's less likely. However, a lot of the time, imported seed will still do fine. You don't have to worry about particular conditions, assuming that they are, you know, rated for our area, and we see them in our area successfully growing.
So what flowers are common in our area or are blooming right now?
Oh, man. Okay, so there are a lot of wildflowers blooming right now. I was not prepared for just how many wildflower species, when I was doing research on this topic, are native to our area and are blooming in May. Typically, because wildflowers are full sun, you're going to see most of the species flowering in June and July with the periods of peak sunlight intensity. But there's still quite a few wildflowers blooming now. You've got wild geraniums. There's a plant called wood betony, which is actually one of the few examples of a parasitic plant. I've seen that all over some of the Missouri conservation areas just on the other side of state line. Wild violets, which are one of the few shade-loving wildflowers. And if you've have a shady yard, you will see these pretty frequently. They're commonly considered a weed in yard situations, but can also be wildflowers. But keep in mind the potential weediness if you are going to plant it near a yard. Indian paintbrush. This will typically be the plant you see on the roadside that looks kind of red. It is a stalk, kind of orangish red, and it does look like a paintbrush. They gave it a really good common name when they named it. Firewheel. Oh, I love this flower. This is my favorite wildflower. It's also called an Indian blanket. It is a daisy species that starts red near the center, and then as you go out, the petals turn yellow. It's also known as Gaillardia if you are looking for the scientific name. It's a very distinct-looking plant. It catches the eye really nicely, and it's a good, not specimen planting, but it's a kind of a good bringer of color to gardens. The clovers, not necessarily thought of as wildflowers, but they are really good for pollinators, and James is going to cover pollinators more after the break. Red and white clover. Not actually native to North America, which is surprising. Well, at least white clover is not. Red clover is. But both will be really good for pollinators, and they're also legumes, which will add nitrogen back into the soil. A lot of people try and fight clover in a lawn, like a lawn context, when really it's a good way to get to reduce your fertilizer needs if you want a lawn that doesn't need as much nitrogen. It can fix nitrogen in the soil through a symbiotic relationship with bacteria at the root system. So that is one way to get a supplemental nitrogen source into your soil. I'm gonna rapid fire these other ones really quickly. Evening primrose, really good in marginal sites. There are a ton growing in the parking lot at the Southeast Kansas Recycling Center in Pittsburgh, and that's just rock. There's no real soil there of which to speak, so that's really good for sites that might be clay or kind of low quality. Cornflower, also known as bachelor's buttons. This is one of those weird ones that kind of toes the line between wildflower and cultivated flower, depending on whether or not you're getting a specific variety. They come in many colors, but the traditional color is blue. If you've ever cooked with corningware, that's the flower that's on the dish. But they also come in like a dark maroon. I've seen pink. They can, depending on the seed source, come in different varieties. So you can buy a variety, and you will still get a lot of the qualities that the wildflower cornflower has. Fleasbane, you'll start seeing daylilies here in ditches pretty soon. The general orange daylily, it's also called the ditch lily, so another really good common name. Coneflower, milkweeds, which are good for monarchs and other butterfly species. Mustards, I got a question about yellow flower on the side of the road about a month and a half ago. That would be a plant called Yellow Rocket. Mustards are really good self-seeders. Dame's Rocket, which was the non-native that I mentioned before, is also a mustard species, but it does, because it is a heavy seeder and not native, it is considered invasive. But most of the mustards that you will see are not. Coneflowers and black-eyed Susans. Those are probably the most common wildflower plantings, and those are both going to be perennial. So while they won't seed as heavily, they should, unless we get severe winters, come back year after year.
All right, and before we get out of here, I think you already said what your favorite one is, but Dad, what are a few of your favorite wildflowers as we got just a few minutes left here?
I love Indian blanket or firewheel or Gaillardia, depending on what you want to call it. There's a lot of different names for it. It's just got a very distinct flower head. A lot of wildlife species use it as a food source. They eat the seeds off the flower. Although it does produce enough seeds to where you will still get plants year after year. I also like the cornflowers because it kind of toes that line. You get a little bit of selection from bred cultivars, but you can also get the wildflower aspect of self-seeding and really good tolerance to our growing conditions. And as much as people don't like clover in their yards, I think clover is a really good plant. Good ground cover. You do need to carefully consider whether or not you're okay with it in your yard, because it can be kind of an escape artist. And it is a good like grass alternative. Or if you don't need an alternative to grass but have some bare spots, it's a good way to fill out some of the bare spots, because it can take some shade, unlike most other wildflowers.
All right, so what we're going to do, we're going to go ahead and take a break. I know we got a caller that wants to call in, and we'll get to you after the break. But before we head to our break, James, what will you be talking about today?
Yeah, so today I'm going to be talking a little bit. I'm actually going to be talking about honeybees, but it's kind of the negative side of honeybees. So what happens when they invade your house or your barn or something? And then a little bit about actually caring for the honeybees too. And so a specific set of pollinators, because there's thousands of them, obviously. But, you know, I think we talk a lot about them. So
all right. So that'll be coming up after the break. You're listening to the Mighty 690K GGF. And good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Greenside Up here on the Mighty 690K GGF. We're going to get to James Coover here in just a moment, but we did have a caller call in right at the end of that segment, and he wanted to ask Jesse a question. And caller, good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Doing pretty good. So you have a question for Jesse this morning.
Yes, I have two questions. The first one is about crepe myrtle. I've got two crepe myrtles, and they got lots of new growth coming down, coming up from the bottom. And then, should I cut off those old stalks coming up all the way down or not?
That kind of depends on how big you want the plant to get. A lot of people think that crepe myrtle should be cut back down to the ground. This can work, but usually you don't want to take off more than a third of a plant's live growth in any given year.
Well, this is the old wood, so I don't think... Is that still alive?
Yes, it is. Crepe myrtle only produces flowers on new wood, so you want right. to prune it back slightly smaller than the size you're okay with it getting to. And when it pushes out the new growth, that's where it's going to flower. So as long as you're kind of keeping it within that rule of thirds where you're pruning off no more than 33%, you can take it down as low as will get up to a third of its live growth, and whatever it pushes out in the following growing season, that's where the flowers will produce. So if you okay. want a lot of flowers, take it down to that third. If you don't need a ton of flowers, only prune it back to slightly smaller than you want the shrub to be, and it will grow out to about the size you want, and you can keep pruning it back to slightly smaller than the size you want year after year, and it will put out new flowers on that new growth.
Okay, very good. Now, the second question I have is about asparagus. Now, I've got some asparagus I planted. I don't think it was planted 2 years ago. Now, I'm just leaving it alone, and it's grown up, and then now I've got a couple of them that have planted in four different places in my yard. And what they've done is they grow up into big, tall stalks, like single stalks, and then they're spreading on the ground where they're spreading out.
Mm-hmm.
And what should I do?
So you were right to plant it and leave it. Asparagus needs time to build up energy reserves because you're essentially cutting off the stem before it can start producing the leaves that will provide a lot of its energy for photosynthesis. So the first year that you grow asparagus, you want the plant to build up energy reserves. So you let it grow. Asparagus has very ferny leaves and produces quite a bit of seed. And after that first year, you cut it back to the ground. Then you would harvest it in the second year. You don't want asparagus to get too tall because then it starts getting really woody in the stem, and okay, it does not make for really good eating. It's probably past the point where you would want to harvest it this year. So it will have a couple years for you of building up those energy reserves. And in the long run, if you can wait a couple of years, that's probably better for the long-term health of the asparagus plot, just in terms of being able to harvest. But in the future, you do want to alternate between years of harvesting and years of allowing the plant to grow, leaf out, and basically just go through a season of replenishing those energy reserves. And you should be able to get asparagus every other year out of the patch.
Okay, well, this is the last year it grew up and it looked like a fern, like you said. This year it's grown up as a stalk. And so should I cut that stalk down to the ground or leave it alone for another year?
At this point, it's probably a little late for harvesting. So,
I wasn't harvesting it to eat. I just wanted for maintenance.
Right. There's no harm in leaving it for the growing season and then basically cutting it down in the fall.
Okay. So let it go until fall.
Yep.
And then cut it all the way back to the ground?
Yep. And next spring, it should push out the stalks that are harvestable and edible.
Okay, very good. That's what I want to know. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you very much, caller. So, again, some good questions there from the caller. All right, let's go ahead and get it over to James Coover. And, James, we're going to be talking about everybody's favorite flying insect. We're going to be talking about bees today. And, for the most part, bees can be positive, but they also do have some negative effects as well, correct?
Yes. And so this time of year, we start to get calls about honeybees in houses. They're introduced insect, but they also can become invasive in a certain way, especially in specific houses. I want to talk a little bit about basically what happens when you find a colony of honeybees inside of your house. And they will basically invade pretty much anywhere they can find. Like if they find a nice home inside of a house, and actually houses are perfectly built for honeybees. there's a really, you know, every between two studs in the wall, there's a gap there that's almost 2 square feet. And so that's almost the perfect spot for a honeybee hive to exist. They happen quite a bit. But extractions from houses are difficult. And it can be almost nearly impossible. And so the only way to get honeybees after they've already been established is to actually pull the entire hive out of the house, which means you have to get into the core of the hive, basically where the queen is. She will never leave. You cannot bait honeybees out. You cannot smoke them out. You cannot find mothballs. That does not work. You cannot get honeybees out of a house unless you actually have to tear them out of a house, which means you got to tear off the siding of the house. You've got to take everything, basically make a hole inside of the house. And that can be expensive. It can be time consuming. The value of the bees is usually far less than the amount of effort it takes to destroy a hole inside of a house. And, of course, you got to repair that house, too. A lot of pest companies, they're not going to mess with honeybees. They don't actually mess with wasps either. They don't want to mess with any stinging insect. The hive, and, you know, another thing is the height is important because you actually have to leave the beehive that you extracted the honeybees into right next to the entrance. that can be very difficult. So if you're talking about a honeybee hive basically in the eave of a house, and it's way up, two stories tall, it's at the very peak, it's very difficult to get those honeybees out of that house. You will have to call a very experienced beekeeper, someone who has done extractions in the past, has all the right equipment to do so. This is not for novices to get to that point. And so, you know, once a house can be repaired, once you get the honeybees out, you've got to repair the house. Because if you don't, the smell of comb and the smell of honey will attract new swarms to go right back into where they started off with. So it can be a difficult, and of course, the older the house, the more likely it is that you're going to have honeybees because there's holes all over the place.
Right.
You know, basically a mouse-sized hole is enough for honeybees to get in and out of. And so, you know.
James, I had some wasps going in and out of some holes around the front door of my house in Pittsburgh, and one day they just kind of disappeared. There were quite a few at one point, and I asked a beekeeper, and the beekeeper said that they are searching for a particular home, and they go to different places, and once they settle on a home, they stop visiting the other places that they were. Do honeybees do that too?
Yeah, actually, they do. And so, you know, the colonies that are established right now, they're always sending out workers all the time to pollinate things. Another thing that they're doing is actually searching for new places to inhabit. And so they'll find a little spot, they'll kind of crawl in, they'll check it out, and they'll go back. At some point, if they start to swarm, they'll seek out that places that they went to before. That honeybee will kind of, I guess, in a way, remember where that was. And so the swarm will go there, and if the queen decides that that's where she wants to set up, then that's where they'll go. So basically, it's kind of a memory system that they have. And yes, they'll constantly flying in and out. Just because you see one honeybee does not mean that you're going to see a lot more later on. It's just that they're searching for a spot. And so it does increase the probability, though. So, you know, if that was a good spot for them to be, so...
So what it is, it's basically like a scout going out and looking for other spots to basically set up house. And if they think it's a good area, the queen will eventually maybe choose that area.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I have no idea how the scout tells the queen things. It's not like they don't have a normal form
great,
of communication.
You know,
yes, I don't know how they... Yeah, that's one of the many things we don't know about bees. But, you know... A lot of people kind of wonder, like, can you leave the honeybees in a wall of a house? Like, what's the harm of them? If they're up there 30 feet, they're not going to bother anyone. It's not a great idea.
Right.
They make a mess of things. They really, you know, of course you have dead bees. The honey, actually, when they digest the honey over the winter, they release moisture because, you know, it's sugar water. And so the water comes out. And, of course, that can ruin the drywall. It can ruin everything, the insulation. It can make a huge mess. And so...
I know that, well, at least when I was observing the wasps around my house, the periods of, like, peak activity were when it was hottest out. Mm-hmm. Is now a good time to kind of seal those potential entrances before the wasps and bees get really active?
Definitely, yeah. And so, you know, if it's not full of bees now, it is definitely a good time. You cannot seal bees inside of a house. So if you have a swarm, you can't wait till evening when they're all home and then seal it up. That will make a huge mess because then you'll have all those dead bees in there and the honey. And so, you know, but you can pretty much seal a wall anytime if it needs to be sealed. During the winter is actually a good time because there aren't any swarms out flying around.
Yeah, I mean, I've already had a couple wasps hanging around my area, and I was able to luckily I was able to kind of see the little area there where they were trying to build a nest at, and was able to shoot it down with some wasp killer. But I have noticed that it's during the heating of the day is when they are most active. Mm-hmm. and that if you're going to spray them, probably the best time is when they go, because basically at sunsets when they kind of go back and go to sleep, and that's usually the best time to kind of attack those areas, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And so with honeybees, of course, you know, we try not to spray them, but
right.
But when you're dealing with something like yellow jackets, which oddly enough live in the same kind of life way that life cycle that honeybees do. And so yellow jackets, they definitely need to be sprayed. I mean, when they're active, like
extremely aggressive.
Yes, but they're way more aggressive than honeybees. And so that's something that actually you might want to call somebody with a beekeeping suit, because you cannot treat those without a beekeeping suit.
Right.
You know, they will sting you. They are very angry little wasps.
And the fact that they can do it multiple times as opposed to a bee one sting, that's it for them. Uh-huh. But wasps can just sting multiple times, and they will do it too.
I've been stung multiple times. So they have no issue with stinging people.
They're just like stab over and over. And then they won't leave you alone either. And I've been stung multiple times by a wasp, and I'm allergic to them. Mm-hmm. Anytime I see a wasp, I just turn into get away. at any cost. But about the bees getting stuck in your wall. So again, that's going to be really expensive too. So what's the best way to kind of find those holes in your house that kind of can keep the bees out? Because like I said, it's about a mouse sized hole that they can start going in and out of.
There's no good way. You just kind of have to search for your house, you know, and really like it can be hard because anywhere the siding, there's a little gap in the siding of your house. They can crawl into that and find wherever the hole is. And so it takes a lot of effort to go through your house and seal up all those holes. And that's the same thing for wasps too, or for mice or any other insect. It's universal. Little gaps in your house are going to attract some sort of small insect because your house is a nice place to live. Ideally speaking, if we want to extract to hide from something, we want to do it out of an old shed or maybe an old tree in a yard. The height is important. Hopefully they're close to the ground. Those extractions are much easier to do. I've done some of them myself. And it's just you kind of pull off the old boards, you grab the bees out, and you put it all back together. It is a thing, but it's something that's much easier to do than actually tearing apart a house. Another thing, though, these are all established hives. When it comes this time of year, there's often not swarms. A swarm is a colony of bees that's just flying out. They don't have a home. This is a completely different situation. Swarms are by far the easiest. They're very docile. Swarms aren't going to sting you unless you go up and smack them.
Right.
You know, don't mess with them. They're not going to mess with you. They don't have a home. They're trying to find a place to live. A beekeeper can go up, take that swarm, dump it in a bee box, and that's it. They found a home, and so they're perfectly fine doing that. As long as the queen is inside the house, all the other bees will swarm or will follow her into the hive. So if you do see a swarm, you know, call a beekeeper because that's money right there. That's a valuable thing to find a swarm. And once you do that, you know, it's actually more valuable now than it will be later in the summer. They'll swarm all the way up to August. They make no sense when they're doing that because they will not survive the later in the season that they swarm. But a beekeeper can keep them alive if they find them later on.
And usually they're pretty willing to come and deal with the swarm, right? You want the bees gone. They want the bees in a hive.
Yes.
It's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Yeah. Swarms, that's money right there. That's a good thing. Bees inside of a house, less of a good situation. So.
And the bees will usually kind of like those bee boxes anyway because it's kind of set up for them and they're ready to go in there.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's kind of a perfect place for bees. That's why we make them. I mean, they're perfectly 2 cubic feet. We can stack them up. It's already full of comb that they can expand on. So, you know, there's a good reason why.
it makes them happy, that's for sure.
All right,
we do have a call, so let's go ahead and get to the phones. And caller, you are on Green Side Up. Good morning. How are you doing today?
Yes, sir. I'm glad you brought up something about the bees today.
Yes.
I belong to the Montgomery County Beekeepers Association, and we have a meeting once a month. It is at the Catholic Church Annex at 414 East Myrtle in Independence. It's open to anybody who wants to learn how to keep bees. It'll be at 6 o'clock this Thursday, which is the 13th. Like I said, we have this every month. It's always the second Thursday of every month, and it's open to the public, and anybody wanting to know anything about bees or would like to get into bees, we're open to the public. Come and ask questions. It's just an invitation to people that may want to get into it.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. No, sounds good. So be able to learn a lot about beekeeping. Again, that's the Montgomery County Beekeeping Association. So thank you so much for calling. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I was actually going to mention the Montgomery County Beekeepers, actually. So that was a good time. Thank you, caller. And so, yes, there are a number of really good beekeeping groups around here if you're interested in getting involved with bees. The Montgomery County one that meets in Independence. There's the Columbus one. And there's also the Heartland that meets in Pittsburgh. And so that's by far the best way to learn about keeping bees. I connect with them on Facebook is the easiest way for me to. So.
All right, looks like we got some more callers here, so let's try to punch those up. And caller, you are on Green Side Up. Good morning. How are you doing today?
Very good, thank you. I have a question about my crepe myrtle. It's showing no signs of life. Is it too early, or what's wrong with it?
So usually when plants show no signs of life, it will be an environmental problem, and I would say that it's likely going to be because of the hard freeze in February and the late freeze we had around the third week of April. In most cases, it will be foliar only, which is just describes that it's affecting the leaves and not the plant as a whole. One good way to check and see if a plant is alive or not in a part that looks like it could be dead is to test the flexibility of the branch, of the twig, of the stem. If it is flexible, it is still getting water and nutrients, and it's just a leaf issue, and it should bounce back in warmer conditions or in the following growing season. If it's dry and brittle and snaps easily when it should be, you know, more flexible, for some reason the plant tissue that brings nutrients and water to that part of the plant has been damaged or is no longer working. Could be a wilt issue, could be burst plant cells from freezes where the water expands and breaks the cell wall. Usually it's going to be cold issues. So while I don't know particularly what could be the issue with the crepe myrtle, my recommendation would be to kind of do that test on some of the outer limbs of the crepe myrtle to see if it's flexible. If it is, it should bounce back in future growing seasons. If it's not, it could be dead and need heavy pruning or replacement. Dead tissue does not contribute to the rule of thirds that I mentioned earlier with the previous caller who asked about crepe myrtles. So you can remove as much dead plant tissue as you need. My recommendation, honestly, would be to wait and see because you will have a better idea of what isn't producing leaves in future growing seasons. It is a aesthetically kind of shocking situation, but usually it's not as severe as it looks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much, caller. And we are pretty much out of time here for this morning. But James, before we get out of here, you guys do have a program coming up, a pretty big one coming up, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so I'll quickly mention the Springfield Day, which will be the Southeast Center there in Parsons, Nest Road and 400, from 8:30 to noonish. We're going to tour the wheat plot tours, talk about all the different varieties, including soft wheat. We're going to have the specialist talk about diseases and cover crops and everything involving wheat, really. And so that will be on May 19th from 8:30 to noon. Call any of the local extension offices to register for that. And we also have tractor safety for any of the farm kids, teenagers that need to learn about doing things safely on the farm, and also for 14 and 15-year-olds to get their certification. And so that will be on May 27th and 28th. And pretty much that's a full-day class thing.
All right. So good stuff coming up, good programs, and lots of great information today. Guys, thank you so much for coming on today. We appreciate it, and we'll see you guys here in a couple of weeks.
Yep, sounds good.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we're going to start Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.